Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
We're here tonight really to celebrate the new work by Ann Packer, who is her new book, Children's Crusade. I've started it, and I'm really enjoying it, so for a lot of different reasons. But to begin tonight's event, we're going to have a conversation with our own, very own Eleanor Brown, whose great book, The Weird Sisters. If you haven't picked that one up, that would also be something. There's a kindredness between the two, if that's a word, I'm making that up, between the two books, both about families and about relationships in a really deep ways that is at the same time seem immediately recognizable in very many ways for all of us who grew up in a family of some sort. So I'm going to hand it over to Eleanor, and she's going to introduce Anne.
Thank you. So I'm Eleanor Brown, and I'm here with Ann Packer, who is the New York Times bestselling author of five books. She has two works of short fiction, Mendocino and Other Stories, and Swim Back to Me, and two bestselling novels, Dive from Clawson's Pier and Songs Without Words. But we're here tonight to talk, as Derek said, about her latest, which is The Children's Crusade. Ann, thank you so much for being here tonight. Thank you for being at the Tattered Cover.
Well, thank you. It's wonderful to be back here. It's such a great bookstore and a great community.
It is. We are super lucky to have it here in Denver. Can you start off just by kind of giving us just a brief overview of what The Children's Crusade is about?
Absolutely. So this is a book about a family in Portola Valley, California, which is essentially Silicon Valley, but the book starts before anyone's calling it that. And it's a book that spans many decades and looks at the relationships among family members and the effect of an unsuccessful marriage on four children. And I think that's enough just to get started, and especially because I'm going to read from the beginning, so you don't need to know anything. And I'm just going to read for about 3 or 4 minutes, and then we will jump into our conversation. So thank you for being here. Okay, Bill Blair received his discharge from the Navy on a September morning in 1954. He'd served on hospital ships off Incheon and Pusan, Korea for 2 years, and then completed his service at the Oak Knoll Naval Hospital, a cluster of wooden barracks on a grassy hillside in Oakland, California. On the afternoon of his discharge, he borrowed a convertible and headed across the Bay Bridge, an unplanned adventure that seemed like just the ticket for a fellow with some time on his hands. The sky was the same lovely shade of blue as the hyacinths in the bridal bouquet at his sister's wedding 4 months earlier. He'd gotten a weekend's leave and made it home to Michigan in time for a pre-wedding family breakfast at which his years of service were so celebrated that the very thing he'd sought from the trip, a return to the life he'd known before open wounds and gangrenous limbs and amputations, slipped finally and irrevocably out of his grasp. Outside the church, he stood with his parents in his dress blues and felt as lonely as he ever had in his life. He'd first seen San Francisco from the deck of the USS Haven under a sky choked with clouds. Now, as he drove, he found himself drawn less to the bright downtown than to the low-lying hills beyond it, beribboned with candy-colored houses. He stayed on the highway, heading for the next set of hills, and soon he was moving alongside the pale bay, approaching the airport. Seagulls swooped out of the sky, tiny icons of the aircraft landing on the glittering tarmac. This was the first convertible he'd ever driven, and despite all his time at sea, he'd never had quite such a confrontation with the wind. His face was pummeled, his hair blown flatter than the bunk of an enlisted man. Up ahead of him, on the prow of the car, the noble, brave Pontiac bore down on the unknown with an attitude of calm determination. Leaving the bayshore, Bill meandered for a mile or two until he found the King's Highway, or so it would be called if the name were rendered in English. This he knew from the bits of Spanish he'd picked up in Oakland. El Camino Real. This King's Highway boasted car lots and supermarkets. Nothing to fill Bill's heart, but every so often a vista opened and included the sudden rise of yet more hills, some thickly forested, others the color of hay bales in autumn. He pointed the chrome Indian westward and drove through the neighborhoods of brand new houses that seemed like decoys for something marvelous he would discover soon. I'll stop there.
That is a great sentence to stop on. I said, after I read this book, I emailed a friend of mine who's also a fan, and I said, she makes it look so easy. So since you started at the beginning, let's talk about the setting. So it takes place in what's now Silicon Valley. So why there, and what about that place informs what happens in the book?
So why there is really because that's where I grew up, and it's where I'm living now. And I tend to write about the place I was living maybe 2 or 3 years before I started the book. So I wrote about Wisconsin after I had left Wisconsin. And then I came home to California, and I've been writing about California ever since. But the choice of Portola Valley in particular comes from a, it's a little surprising for me, I think. What happened was I was thinking about this family, and I was thinking at first only about 2 children, and later that moved into 4 children, and I began to imagine them in this community right next to where I grew up. I grew up on the Stanford campus. It was very groomed and tidy, and we had sidewalks and stores we could ride our bikes to. Just over the hill is Portola Valley, which is wild and rustic and full of old oak trees. And when I was taken as a child to visit a family who lived in Portola Valley, I had this impression that they were unsupervised. They were free. And they were just running wild on their property, essentially. And often they were barefoot. And for some reason, once I had these 4 children in mind, I saw them on a property in Portola Valley, running around barefoot. And being of a more constrained nature, I started thinking, they're going to need a tetanus shot. And next thing I knew, they had a pediatrician for a father. So that's really how it came about. And one of the things that the book is about is the way home changes and the way the communities we know change and how that affects us in adulthood. And because it's my home, I know very, very well how Silicon Valley, as it's now called, has changed, how it has become this place that's all about striving and money and, the high school that I went to is now the high school where there's a rash of suicides among the students. So, I wasn't thinking about that specifically with the book, but the characters, the 4 children, we meet them throughout their childhood, and then we connect with them in adulthood as they each take a turn telling the story. That was essentially their community changing. And I wanted to write about the ways that that loss affects our sort of ownership of our adulthood.
Mm-hmm. So one of the other things that I felt really strongly that this book was about, at least to me, was the way that our families form the people that we are. What are your thoughts on that? Is it nature versus nurture? Does it have to do with gender? Does it have to do with birth order? Is it coincidence? How do these children get to be the people they are?
Well, I think I'd rather talk about my thoughts about it in general than my thoughts about the characters in the book, because I don't want to say they are the way they are for any particular reason. But I mean, I think the answer has to be everything. And birth order is hugely important. Gender is hugely important. Temperament, hugely important. And environment, hugely important. So in a sense, it's for each child, it's a combination of those elements. And in addition, the environment changes as children are added. So the oldest child is going to be born into an environment with no children. And by the time the youngest is born, it's a house full of kids. And that's a very different place to grow up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you allude to that in there, which is this idea that I love, that every child has a different family and different parents, right? You know, because as the parents gain experience.
Right. No two siblings have the same parents, basically, right. Because the relationship constructs the people in it.
So one of the things, my novel, The Weird Sisters, was very much concerned with birth order, and people really latch on to that. And one of the things that I found was that people's reactions to the characters depended on their own birth order. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it would be that they would actually dislike the character who was their same birth order the most. I think maybe because they saw themselves in it or something. Have you had any people react to that in any way?
Not so much about birth order, but definitely people have been reacting to the characters in a way that feels very revealing to me. Mm-hmm. There's a very worried and high-achieving firstborn. The secondborn is the only girl, and she's the serious, smart, competent one. The third child is sensitive and dreamy, and the fourth is a wild man.
And I should say, I'm a youngest child, and I totally loved that youngest child. I was like, you are my people.
As a side note, somebody posted on my Facebook page a little video of four goats, and one of the goats is just hopping around on top of the other goats, and she wrote, James? That's the character's name. Anyway, in terms of people's reactions, I haven't, you know, the book's only been out for a couple weeks, so I haven't heard much, but I do know very, very well what my early readers thought. And I had one reader who said about this James character, you know, he is so unremittingly horrible. It's really hard to understand how at the end anybody likes him. And another person was like, he's adorable. I love this guy.
He's totally adorable. So he's the youngest.
It's all over the map.
So since you read that passage, let's just touch on the father. So he's a Korean War veteran, and his experiences there kind of start the story. You have this great moment where he goes back to see his family of origin at the beginning, and he says he's upset because he says his family had mistaken him for a hero, which I just loved. But then he kind of becomes the hero of the family in a lot of ways. Can you talk a little bit about the father and his role as a character?
Yeah, so I don't know really where he comes from in terms of how I can often trace a character and sort of figure out why I created that particular character or gave him those character traits. Bill Blair is this very saintly pediatrician. He's the good father times 100 or times 1,000. His concern in life, he's a person who is highly principled, and the most important principle to him is this idea that children deserve care. And this becomes a kind of rallying cry in the book, and it's certainly the moral fulcrum. And a lot of the conflict and tension comes from the fact that his wife, whose name is Penny, doesn't act as if she agrees with him. So he's a leader of his children, and a very loving father. And as you progress through the book, I think one of the things that happens to readers is they start thinking, is he too good?
So I want to come back to him and that issue in particular, but let's dance over to the mother for a minute, because she is a major character here. She's an artist who's struggling to reconcile her desire to create art and her need for solitude with her identity as a mother. And you can disagree if that's not a good portrait of her.
Absolutely.
But can you talk a little bit about Penny?
Yeah, so Penny is She's a almost a classic 1960s or 70s housewife, just hearing about and thinking about feminism and wanting to use the ideas that are sort of in the cultural air to justify her desire to get away from her kids. She's, I think what is certainly fair to say about her is that she is not a natural born mother. It's, it requires patience and, self-denial. And she's doesn't have a lot of either of those things. So it's really a struggle for her with the first three. And then when James comes along, who is a hellion, It's the breaking point for her and, in a sense, for the whole family.
So she kind of, in some ways, steps out of her role as being a mother to pursue her art, and the father becomes the hero of the family. And so I was thinking about this, and you and I were talking about this earlier, that I feel like the mother is going to be one of these characters who's going to be really ripe for discussion, you know, and it's you're going to get a lot of information about yourself from the way you react, about the way you react to her. But I was thinking a lot about how really it's the father and the kids' reactions to him that influence them in some ways more than I think the mother.
Well, it's interesting. I think that the it's a different kind of influence, and it shows up in different ways in the different kids. I explained earlier, I think that Robert is this the firstborn. He's a high achiever and he's a worrier. And in adulthood, his father's rectitude is actually a problem for him, and he. He sort of imagines his father watching his every move, even his every thought, and, you know, weighing in, was it good, was it bad? And it's a very inhibiting thing. Rebecca, I think, has been the most successful in internalizing the idea that children deserve care, and in fact is a child psychiatrist, and has devoted her life to listening in a way that she was listened to by her father. Early in the book, there's a moment when she has checked out some books from the library, the All of a Kind Family. I don't know if any of you read those books, but he sees them and says, oh, you've been having sister wishes, haven't you? We've got to get a friend over to play with you. And she thinks that sometimes he knew what she wanted even before she did. And then Ryan has internalized love, and he's a very loving father. And then there's James. And I don't even want to hazard a description except for to say that Bill and James have a very, very close and complicated relationship.
It's so fun to hear you talk about these characters. It kind of makes me miss them a little bit. They're beautifully drawn and really well put together. So since we mentioned Penny and kind of that unsuitedness for motherhood, unsuitedness? We're creating all kinds of fun words tonight. Unsuitedosity.
I like that one.
So I read a piece somewhere that said that your work was concerned with selfishness. And I think they were specifically referring to Children's Crusade and Dive from Clawson's Pier. What do you think of that?
Well, it was even more interesting is that it was phrased that I am a connoisseur of the selfish act. That was in the New York Times book review.
Okay, well, I don't know that I read it that way, but I thought it was an interesting question.
No, it's a very interesting question, and I love the idea of being a connoisseur of the selfish act, as if I have, you know, within me and in my history, so many of them to join, just pull from and describe in fiction. I am very interested in how we fail each other. And in how we please each other and help each other. But in disappointment. And I think disappointment in relationships often comes around what one party is going to call a selfish act or selfishness. Mm-hmm. And I think when I wrote The Dive from Clausen's Pier, which is about a young woman who leaves her paralyzed fiancé and runs off to New York, I wasn't thinking at all generally. But it came to be thought of as a book that really looked at the question of how much we owe the people we love. And that was like just a throwaway line in the book, and it became, you know, this tagline, and it was used in the copy, and it became very important. And I think that I think I'm interested in how we navigate our expectations of each other and of ourselves.
So what does the Children's Crusade have in common then with your other work? Or could you sum up, you know, I write about selfish acts. I'm a connoisseur of selfish acts.
You know, I think that what the reviewer who said that I was a connoisseur of the selfish act was referring to, it was the Mother Penny and her essentially, if not abandoning, then certainly loosening her grip on and her interest in her children in favor of making her own art. And I don't know that I would want to generalize across my entire body of work, but I think that that need to follow an impulse away from important relationships and toward the development of an independent self is always of interest to me.
If you could give this book, if you could give The Children's Crusade to one person, who would you give it to?
Well, I'm going to have to say Barack Obama. And hopefully he would be photographed holding it.
He can buy it on Small Business Saturday, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Gosh, that is a really interesting question.
I totally stole that from author Alex George, by the way, who asked it to me, and I think it's fascinating.
It is, and I don't think I can answer it beyond my jokey retort, except for to say someone who can benefit from it right now. And that would be kind of in the eye or mind of the beholder. It's not like I want my books to help or heal people, but my goal as a writer is to give to someone else the kind of incredible, meaningful experience that I get when I read certain works of fiction.
Well, let me actually jump right to that then. So what are some books that you go back to again and again? Is there anything you've read recently that really sticks with you?
You know, who I go back to all the time is Alice Munro. And she's at the top of my list every time. Fortunately, I no longer have to explain who she is, which I did used to have to do long ago. It's interesting, when I think about my favorite writers, I often think about short story writers. Mm-hmm. I've written 3 novels, 2 collections of stories, but I'm always going to list Charles Baxter, Tobias Wolff, Laurie Moore, George Saunders, and I'm talking contemporary. I mean, sure. If we want to open it up to my entire reading history, it's going to get very complicated and start weighing toward the past, mm-hmm. to Austin and Eliot and Wolff and all kinds of people. In terms of contemporaries, I can't highly enough recommend Kate Walbert. So if you guys have not read Kate Walbert, either A Short History of Women or The Gardens of Kyoto, that's your next book. Well, second to next.
Right, The Children's Crusade is first in line. Can we talk a little bit about writing?
Absolutely.
Okay, so I read an interview where you talked about your writing as an intuitive process rather than something that is planned out. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, writers seem to fall into 2 groups. One where we're just, you know, making our way in the dark, feeling our way forward, not knowing what's coming. And others where a writer will really plan, even write an outline, you know, come up almost with storyboards for scenes. And I'm firmly in the first camp, not out of principle, but that's just the only way I can do it. I've tried. I cannot make even a list of ideas. And it's partly because they come out of my fingertips. They come out of the process of being at the computer and writing a sentence. And so one sentence really spawns the next sentence. And in this book in particular, I really didn't know where I was going and often entered a paragraph with no idea how I was going to get out of it or where the narrative would go next, which is, you know, really scary.
I was just going to say, as a writer, that sounds terrifying.
But fun. I had a great time, actually, writing this book. It was a lot of fun.
So did you ever lose your way entirely? Like, I don't know what's going to happen to this family. I don't know what these children are doing. Did you ever feel totally lost?
Well, I never had a way to lose. I mean, I never knew where I was going, so there was nothing to misplace or find that I was no longer in possession of, you know, a sense of arrival. The structure is complicated, and it goes back and forth between an omniscient narrator who tells the sort of, gives the long view of the family and dips in and out of the family history at important moments. And then the four children as adults, as I said, are telling the story, but it's braided so that you're not only going from one narrator to another, but you're going from past to present, past to present. Mm-hmm. I did have a sense of the order that the siblings would tell their stories in, from oldest to youngest. So I knew it was going to end with James, and I knew what James's problem was, and I knew how it was going to end. So I think it's probably not accurate to say I really didn't know, but I just, in sort of a general shape kind of way, I had a sense of a destination.
So did you then kind of revise as you went, or do you just tear through and then go back and polish?
I write very slowly and polish as I go. So, you know, on a given day, I will sit down and read what I wrote the previous day and revise it. And it might take me, you know, I might get caught up in that revision and be there for an hour or more before I actually arrive at the point where I had left off and move forward. And it's on a sentence level. So, you know, I write three sentences, go back, change it, try to finish the paragraph, go back, work on it some more, make my way to the end of the paragraph, start the next paragraph, and then maybe write three paragraphs before I end up going back. But it's a constant forward and backward motion.
So at what point then does the story, and I guess more, what point do the dramatic questions that you're trying to answer come to you? So you referred to Die from Clausen's Pier, that kind of throwaway line that kind of became the central talking point for the book. Do you know what you're writing about from the beginning? Does it come out as you're writing, or is it not until the publicity department says, we really love this line, we want to use it?
Not until. I definitely, I have no idea. I don't think in themes. So for me, it's very, very much about character and creating character sentence by sentence. And I can see themes developing, you know. I mean, I can see a marriage becoming more and more troubled, but it's not like I think, oh, I'm writing about troubled marriages in the 70s and 80s. That is always an after-the-fact attempt to, you know, package the book so that it can be handed to the reader or a group of readers. And it's part of the process, but it's not something I think about at all while I'm writing.
But then we were talking earlier that it's this really interesting where you give it to a reader and you kind of never know what they're going to get out of it.
And often what they did get out of it. I mean, one of the strange and sort of wonderful things about putting a book into the world, especially a work of fiction, is that something is going to happen in the mind of every reader where that person is going to bring his or her history to the book and interpret accordingly, and mostly I'll never know a thing about it. So I've I've given up my hold on the book and given it to an audience so that they can hold it in a different way. And what's so great about being able to tour and meet audiences in bookstores or wherever, and this is more the case with a paperback because people have had time to read the book, is getting to hear what those reactions were. And I just love that. That's so much fun. And I think, you know, people are likely to begin to think about their own sort of sibling relationships and the way that in adulthood they and their siblings do or don't try to make sense of the past.
So you talk about readers' reactions to your work. Have you ever been surprised by readers' reactions to your work? Have you ever been surprised by what they got out of the book or what they brought to you?
Not exactly surprised, but I had one experience that has really stuck with me just because it was so incredibly revealing, unintentionally revealing. I was at an event, and there was this woman who came up afterwards. She wanted her book signed. Then she kept lingering. She kept, like, sort of, you know, getting in on conversations I was having with other people. She clearly really wanted to talk about it. And finally, the line emptied out, and she came up, and she said, "You know what's wrong with this book?" And she slapped her hand on the table. She said, "You know what's wrong with this book? Nobody wins." And I just thought, wow, thank you for that. You know, thank you for giving so much to me by being honest and, you know, revealing your worldview in a sense. It was fascinating.
Yeah, I've often said that, not to intimidate you guys because I'm about to ask you for questions, but I've often said that the questions that people ask me about my book often reveal as much about them as it does, you know, about the book, you know, when it comes out. But it's like you said, you know, every child grows up in a different family. Every reader reads a different book.
Exactly. That's a great analogy.
You also teach writing.
I have returned to teaching writing recently. I taught writing in graduate school and just after, and then sort of set it aside to finish my first novel and raise my kids. And kid number two has now gone to college, and so I decided I'd like to try teaching again, and have been leading some private classes in my home community and also in New York, where I spent several weeks last fall teaching at the Center for Fiction.
What do you like to teach?
I like to just teach a workshop. I'm the opposite of the kind of fiction writing instructor who wants to generalize or to talk about published work and how it's functioning. I want my students to write, and then I want to help them make it better.
What do you find that your students often need as writers?
I think the most pressing need is usually development, that what's on the page is often really skeletal, and particularly character development, which is obviously a big part of what I care most about. But I will often say to a student, I don't know who these people are. I don't know how they really talk to each other. We've got a little dialogue here. Go write a 4-page scene where they're just talking. I don't care what they're talking about. And see if you can dig deeper into those characters and pull some contradictions and surprises out of them.
Well, I would say if you want a great lesson on that, The Children's Crusade is absolutely that. These are really fully, beautifully fleshed out characters, especially the youngest child. Well, he is kind of a force of nature. You'll see when you read it. So now that I've terrified you all by telling you that we're going to psychoanalyze you by the questions that you ask, what questions do you have for Anne?
Mine's more of a writing question. As far as short stories and novels go, which do you have strong feelings about either writing-wise or reading?
So the question is if you have a preference for reading or writing novels, writing novels versus short stories.
I definitely don't have a preference about what I write. And I wouldn't say I have a preference about what I read. I tend to gravitate toward novels because I want to be immersed for a longer period of time. That said, I love the short story. And if I had to identify my favorite works of fiction, they're going to be short stories. So it's sort of a paradoxical thing.
So how do you decide what you're going to write next?
You know, as I begin to think about characters or a setting or a line of dialogue or just a line of a story, I have a sense of the size of the thing that's behind that idea. So I haven't ever sort of gotten it wrong. Although I did once write a short story, and years later decide to revisit the situation in the story. And that became the novel Songs Without Words.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Do you write those concurrently? Do you ever write a short story while you're working on a novel, or they kind of happen one at a time?
I pretty much work on one thing at a time, but part of my process is that I'm in a writer's group, and I really, really value their input when I have a finished draft of something. So in periods when I've asked my group to read a manuscript, I will often turn to something else to work on, you know, especially if it's going to be 4 weeks or something, which is really, you know, a minimum if you're giving someone 500 pages. But there's always a most important work, so that once it comes back, I'm going to set aside the thing that I had been working on and work on the primary thing again.
Other questions? Derek, go ahead.
I recently moved back to the same neighborhood where I grew up. So, and wow, the 25 years or so is a very different place. But more important, my folks are still there, and I keep thinking about that. Could you say a little bit more about that? I mean, how in those subtle ways we either disappoint or fail expectations for each other.
So can you talk a little bit more about what you said earlier about the ways that we disappoint each other or fail in our expectations for one another?
Well, I think it's really about being fascinated by the way people work both internally and in relationship. I am first and foremost a writer of psychological realism, and I'm interested in the psyche. So I think that in terms of failing each other, in a sense, that's what happens between people when there's a problem. And a story isn't a story unless there's a problem. So it kind of comes about that way. I'm interested in conflict. I'm interested in the ways that people try to get what they want and what happens when they don't. And it's often from another person. So I think that kind of that's what prompted me to make that statement earlier about having that interest in how we feel each other. I feel like I made a claim about a theme that I wouldn't necessarily have listed if someone had said to me, "What themes are you interested in?" But it as I talk about it and think about your question, I recognize that that's what the human conversation is about. It's how we fail and don't fail each other. Because ultimately, I guess I have a slightly tragic view of life, in the sense that I know that there's a lot of disappointment. But then I also want to look at how those collisions get arrested and what kinds of possibilities for contentment there might be.
And I think it's interesting that you talk about that, because in the Children's Crusade, you have each one of the children take turns narrating in first person. And so we get this interesting view not only of of how they think other people have failed them, which isn't always necessarily the case, right? But we, you know, because we have expectations, we see it in other people.
Well, that's a really, really good point. And I think that getting it wrong is really interesting. People getting each other wrong, misunderstanding each other's intentions is another big part of how things get complicated in relationships. And certainly one of the things that the adult siblings in the book struggle with is how to think about each other's choices and whether or not someone's choice can be a challenge to one's own ideas about how best to live.
So the other thing that Derek mentioned in his question was this issue of place and kind of how place is important to us and how it forms us and returning to us. So I just want to jump back for a second to ask you another question about that. So this is set in what's now Silicon Valley. And when he purchases the land, it is very much not Silicon Valley. So one of the central questions of the book, well, I wouldn't say central question, one of the central plot points of the book revolves around whether they should sell the family house or not. Because obviously it's now in Silicon Valley. It is worth an enormous amount of money. I have no idea what question I was going to ask at the end of that, but you're going to ask a question. Okay, go right ahead. Save me from myself.
Today.
Go for it. That's a great question. I'm going to have a really hard time summing up, but I guess basically, can you talk a little bit more kind of about how like Silicon Valley and class and the money that comes to it are part of that, and was that something you were thinking about as you were writing?
Not really. I don't really think about themes. Themes, like I said, develop, and readers see them and interpret aspects of the book according to their interest. So somebody, one reader may be really taken up with the part of the book that's about the changes in Silicon Valley, and another reader might be more taken up by questions of mother-son relationships, right? But I wasn't thinking about either of them in a general way. It's all about the characters for me as I'm writing and making them behave, in a sense. You know, what I'm trying to do is make them read as I want them to. And, of course, that goes to the question of, you know, multiple interpretations. So that's part of why I have the writers group, is I get early on to find out how it's coming across, or, you know, essentially what's happening on the other side of the page. And it's not like I, you know, get feedback from my writers group and then go, you know, implement the changes one by one. It gives me a sense of what kind of impact things are having. And it's just invaluable.
I think we have time maybe for one more question. Sure, go ahead.
I was just curious about what your you know, kind of process is for writing. I mean, if you have a regular ritual of how you do it, or if it varies a lot.
You know, I don't. I write very freely, without a schedule or without sort of ideas about how many hours a day or days a week I need to be working. And it's not because it's just so easy. I just have never found that it's helpful to make requirements of myself. Typically, the way it works is at the beginning of a book, it's hell. And sitting in the chair and staying in the chair when you have no idea what you're doing is really excruciating. As you pick up steam and start to develop ideas about where you're going, it becomes more and more fluid. And at the end, at least for me, and I think this is true for a lot of other writers, maybe Eleanor, you can comment, it's all the time. You just don't want to be doing anything else. And I think it's those moments, it's for those moments that we do it at all. Because that there's sort of nothing like that.
Well, I think that is a great, wonderful note to end on. So, Ann Packer, thank you so much for being here. Her latest novel is The Children's Crusade. Thank you so much for being a Tattered Cover.
Thank you so much, and thank you, everybody, for coming.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.